Hello and welcome to this episode of Battling Business with me, Chris Kitchener.
And me, Gareth Clement.
In this podcast, we explore ideas and concepts around teams and teamwork, leaders and leadership, and all things in between. It's a discussion between a former Royal Marines officer and a product manager from the world of business, comparing and contrasting our experiences as we attempt to work out what make teams, leaders, and businesses tick. And we are very, very pleased to have a guest. Would you like to introduce our guest?
Yeah, so this week we're delighted to be joined by Paul Tremelling, who I met Paul, oh gosh, 6-7 years ago on a business course that we were both undertaking. It's a short business course for people that were transitioning out of the military. And Paul sat behind me and copied all my homework, I think.
Copied, okay, but that's fighting till the start. So that was, frankly, I don't think that shows enough respect to our guest. So I'm going to do the proper one that I wrote before rather than your...
Fair enough.
He copied my work introduction. We've not had anyone leave before they start, but maybe today. Look, as Gareth said, Paul Tremelling, I think it's well worth talking about his history, particularly with the aviation interest that I have. I'm very excited to have Paul. So Paul joined the Royal Navy in 1996 and flew the Sea Harrier on 800 Squadron, 801 and 899. He qualified as an air warfare instructor, which for those of you in the aviation world know that is not a simple thing. Only the best go ahead and do that. Then as the Sea Harrier capability was removed, he transitioned to the Harrier, the RAF Harrier, so that would be the GR9, and served on the Naval Strike Wing, a unit where he became senior pilot. So really in a complex and challenging world, moving to the top of that world. Beyond then, he was selected for exchange duties with the US Navy. And Paul, if the Sea Harrier and the GR9 wasn't enough, then moved on to fly the FA-18E Super Hornet with VFA-25, who are known as, and I do like this, see, this is why I do still wish I'd have been involved in that world. The squadron is the fist of the fleet, the fist of the fleet. He then fitted in 3 desk tours, and I think we might actually talk about some of that work because there's some really interesting stuff around air accident investigation, as well as operational duties in Afghanistan and off Libya. And Paul was mentioned in dispatches following an action, which I think we might even talk about a bit later in Afghanistan. And I actually read Paul's book, which is Harrier, How to Be a Fighter Pilot. And I know it's a trope. When you get guests on, you have to be nice to say, oh, it's a great book. No, actually, I read this one in about 2 days in a couple of sittings. Whether you are interested in aviation or you want a rip-roaring read or you want to understand a little bit of the culture of the Royal Navy, genuinely, this is a great book. And just to show how corny I am, I think, Paul, I might ask him to sign my book at the end of this. Anyway, welcome, Paul, to the podcast. Over to you after we've bigged you up so much.
Yeah, just thank you very much indeed. Both intros very accurate. I did pinch Gareth's homework.
So this is more for me than for listeners, maybe, but we obviously this, the whole point of this is leadership and management lessons. And actually in your book, you do talk a lot about this. But before we go there, I don't know that certainly the civilian people listening to this really understand what it means to fly, firstly, a fast jet aircraft, but something as complex as the Sea Harrier was. And for those of you who don't know, it's it was a vertical landing aircraft, so it goes up and down as well as forward and backward. See my technical knowledge there. But on a very small piece of ship, so maybe a good way to start more for me, how do you land a Sea Harrier on a deck at night in the middle of nowhere?
So the simple answer is... You start off by absolutely listening and taking as gospel any bit of advice you're given. So as far as getting back goes, finding the ship is usually a bit of a challenge, but no great shakes really, in so much as you know roughly what bit of sea it's in, but probably not accurate enough to actually go and land on. For that, you have to follow certain procedures that get you around the back of it at the right height at the right time, which is important because it's a team game. If you're off your time, then the person in front probably doesn't care, but the two people behind you probably do. And it being a, you've already alluded to it, V-stall machine, you have to get your fuel absolutely right, because on the one hand, you don't want to run out, and on the other hand, then you don't want to be too heavy, so you won't be able to hover. And for, just to clear up any doubt, I don't think I ever did a night landing in a Harrier or Sea Harrier that had the option to go anywhere else. You are absolutely committed to the deck, and there comes a time when you tell the ship, I'm at that point now, you either send me ashore or we all commit to making this work. Thereafter, that's when your hands and feet take over, I suppose, and it's just really a case of establishing a stable hover in the darkness alongside the ship, which is what actually makes it slightly tricky compared to other forms of landing, in that you do a descent as any aeroplane does anywhere in the world, and loads of folk have flown at night, but you're doing it into the darkness beside what you're trying to land on, not actually aiming at it.
And the thing that you're trying to land on is still moving.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's moving in all sorts of ways, in that it will be going forward, but it'll be rocking and rolling as well. And this is nothing to do with leadership management or anything, but the key skill at that point is to ignore that and establish a stable hover. It doesn't matter what the wind and waves and ship are doing, stable hover. Your job is to fly nice corners of the box and come down where some brave soul is holding a handheld torch to show you where to land. And ta-da, you're done. And it's a fabulous but daft way of paying the mortgage, is the way I would describe it.
So, I mean, we always do the bit where Gareth says, don't talk about that because we're ruining the recording, we haven't talked about it. But
yeah,
that has to be scary. I mean, I have limited aviation experience, and I remember some moments when I was above cloud and I didn't know how to get below cloud. I was at that stage of my flight. And I know that real fear of this could go wrong. I have to imagine that goes up a couple of levels. You've done lots of training. How do you feel when you're doing that, or even the first time? And how do you overcome that, maybe?
I think you're absolutely right. So you do get what we used to refer to as disco leg, as in when one of your legs would start shaking, there was nothing you could do about it. And that was quite odd, actually, from a psychosomatic point of view. And there were times, it never happened at night, but I remember clearly in the day, actually out loud telling my hands to stop following the ship. And because that was such a hard sensation to overcome. Yes, it is anxious, but I think you just have to convince yourself that the procedures work. If I have my fuel set at 10 minutes to land, it will work out. The engine will be able to produce the amount of thrust I need it to when it really, really matters. The ship and the team will be on the designated flying course. The wind will be within the limits when I come alongside. And that's just something you have to hang your hat on. I remember a really small sort of microcosm of this, for example, is when they put us through the Dunker the first time, the underwater escape trainer. There was one guy on our course who essentially failed because he wouldn't believe that the underwater air supply would work. And I'm quite matter of fact about that. They wouldn't send us to the bottom of a swimming pool with one if it didn't work. So put it in your mouth, crack on. So I think there's an element of not blind faith, because you've got to be watching for all the outs and the things that are going to trip you up. Analogies never quite fit, but if you can just imagine walking along a ridge, your job's to stay on that ridge. Everything will be trying to knock it off you, but so long as you do, the procedures will work, the tech will work, and the other members of the team will do their bit.
It's really interesting that you talk about procedures, and you've alluded to having to do the maths in terms of fuel calculations, in terms of keeping track of where the carrier is. And I think I've talked about the three operating domains of land, maritime and air, and I've used the analogy of sports. I've talked about in the maritime environment, it's a bit like rowing. Everybody's on the ship. Everybody's going in the same direction. You have to be in sync. You have to work as a team. In the land environment, it's a bit like a rugby team, in that you never know exactly where everybody else is on the pitch. The ball can very quickly move around and whoever's got the ball is clearly the focus of the opposition's activity. And so leadership becomes a very different characteristic. And then in the air environment, typically the fast jet world as well, I thought about it in terms of a motor racing team, where there is a whole team of people getting a piece of machinery and the person that's going to operate that machinery into a place where they can then operate and succeed, there is clearly a very procedural, very mechanical, very mathematical aspect of it. But you've already alluded to the complexity of the operating environment. And so it strikes me that there's sort of three very different things that collide. One is a very, very precise piece of machinery that needs to be treated with respect, that needs to be operated within its limits. There is a constantly changing and complex operating environment that you need to be responsive to. And then there is a whole team of people that are working hard to make sure that you're in a position to do that. And that strikes me as an incredibly difficult challenge, because you might be very, very good at procedure, very good at maths and mental arithmetic, very good at leadership, very good at being responsive to dynamic situations. But to find somebody that's good at all three, I would say, is quite challenging. Is that a fair description? And how do they create people that are capable of managing those three things simultaneously?
I think it probably is a fair description, but I'd be at pains to say that you off-ramp an awful lot into that last bucket, which is the teamwork. The problem, though, becomes, and I don't want to stretch the analogy too far, with naval aviation, there's lots that can go wrong at a really trivial administrative level on an aircraft carrier that is actually quite dangerous. So for example, the reason that you might crash might be because the tractor driver drove the tractor at the wrong speed or the wrong time, and therefore fouled the flight deck just after you were told that you were now non-diversion. So I think the key there is actually one of management and supervision across the team, and having people in the right places to say, actually, you know, that job does seem like pretty trivial, but you're the critical element at the moment. So I don't think all those skills are necessarily wrapped up in one person at any one time. But I do think that the dovetailing together of all the different teams is probably a skill in itself.
So we talk about teamwork to the point of almost cliche, but I think you articulated that really well, which is there's lots of people, any one of them could kill you, any one of them could make you successful, kind of thing. How did you bring that team together? So your casual example, I think, is a really good one. There's a tractor driver, he's driving around. How does the Royal Navy help that guy understand this is the part you play and this is what can happen if you aren't on it? Did you go and talk to the tractor drivers and say, guys, don't kill us, this is what can happen. If we don't see you there, we're going to hit you. Or is there a book that says this is what you have to do? How do you bring that together?
The answer is actually probably disappointingly, most of it's done by osmosis, in that it's done by people cuffing people and say, no, I saw that in a previous ship, I saw that in a previous example. I don't have it with me, but I have a video of a new lad on the deck running in front of an aeroplane and getting grabbed back by someone else who realized what he was doing. We protect aircraft from stuff being ingested. He saw something that was about to be ingested and thought, I know what, I'll go and collect it. Obviously at exactly the wrong time, because there was a jet coming at him at 100 knots and someone more experienced said, no, you know, you'll kill yourself. I think, and this was highlighted to me, to be honest, Chris, by I once was helping a bunch of people that were about to get promoted, and their task they had been set was to design some training that brings out the importance of flight safety on an aircraft carrier. And they had found this amazing video of a US Marine Corps helicopter essentially messing up a landing and crashing off the back of it. It gets its rear port undercarriage stuck in the net. Now, all the other leaders that were there sort of gave them, well done, brilliant, well done, brilliant, well done, brilliant. And I was able to say that, sadly, I think you've missed the mark, because that means nothing to anyone who's not a helicopter pilot. It doesn't show you why the communication teams need to get the tasking order. It doesn't show you why, for example, the replenishment teams need to get us the right fuel at the right quality. So there were opportunities like that, but I don't think that we went out of our way to explain these challenges, and that actually led to a little bit of toxicity at times, because when, you know, we always used to joke about the surface fleet guys, is that you know, a ship, even if a ship runs out of fuel or is in the wrong place at the wrong time, it never sinks, it just keeps bobbing around. Trying to explain that, no, genuinely, I've got 90 seconds here, fellas, and at the end of that, I'm going for a swim was quite hard. And I think we tended to do that by a Mickey taking almost and in very short debriefs.
So it feels like the osmosis statement is a really interesting one. And I don't know, I'm not convinced it's entirely osmosis. I suspect it's you have seasoned people in seasoned jobs doing the right thing, and part of their responsibility is to do the things you've talked about. Is there either a formal way where they make sure that successfully happens, i.e. you don't want 9 times out of 10 the guy grabs the young guy running in front of the jet, you want it 10 times, or does it show there are risks there and maybe this is where accidents do happen? And I'm saying this less because of sort of the military situation, more because of the, you know, in a business world, I think this idea of experience and formal and informal structures to protect people is really powerful. I'm really interested in how do you replicate that? It's always easy to say we should have a bunch of experienced people and then bad things won't happen. It's one step further forward. What do you do?
The answer is you do put those supervisors in place. So yes, as people went through, for example, the School of Flight Deck Handling, they would, of course, have been told how important their role is. But that's a completely different kettle of fish to the person basically manoeuvring an old aircraft around at Cold Rose to the time pressure's on. If we don't get this thing to the back of the ship, we won't have it refueled in time for the next sortie. But there's another aeroplane in the way. And there are jets inbound, etc. So that level of pressure is really hard as well. And so probably the informal bit comes to, you know, the sage eye, knowing when to stop is a good one as well. And say, well, you know what, we're only going to launch 3 in the next wave then, because if we move now, we'll cause an absolute haulic. So there was a formal system, and forgive me for using the phrase osmosis. What I do mean, of course, is a suitable amount of experienced people giving sage advice to folk who would look up to them.
Yeah, I think that's institutionalized in the military, as in, actually, I think osmosis is a perfectly reasonable statement, because you know there are all these other structures that mean it ends up being osmosis. I think in the civilian world, it's much more difficult, because the implication is someone has said, are there the right experienced people? Do we have a combination of practical training, basic training? And I think sometimes that gets lost in the way. People see something happening well and assume it's easy, don't try hard enough, and it fails, and they're all surprised.
I think as well that the military, certainly in the aviation circles, would be very, very quick. For example, if you were to say, Chris, I need 3 people to do a particular job worldwide, you're giving me these 3 people at this rank. In your blood would be, you can't. They're my middle order batting. They're absolutely critical for flight safety. Whereas maybe in the business world, you say, oh, okay, well, maybe someone else would take a part of those tier.
Exactly
while.
Right.
Maybe someone can cover for a month. I think that's probably a significant difference.
I think also the formality of the rank structure and the fact that in the military world, people have to go through the ranks in order to promote. You can't be brought in as an expert at a sort of superior level because of experience in another organization. And therefore, everybody has, at some point in their career, been in those ranks below them. And therefore, the empathy with how
and the experience
the things
and the
that
journey.
They need to learn, the experience that you've got that you can impart, that it comes more naturally, but it is also an encouraged part of the CLM process in the military.
So there's a fascinating statement I have heard throughout my business career, and Paul, you might have done as well, obviously more recently outside of the Royal Navy, but I'm going to ask an innocent question. Is there too much process in the world of naval aviation?
I used to think that was a little bit too much.
To talk about that. And here's my context. I hear almost every day, there's too much process. If only we didn't have as much process, we'd be faster and more agile. And I think I get nervous about that statement. Yes, sometimes there can be too much process. Sometimes your overhead is more than you need. But actually, I wonder whether it's the right amount of process. So I'd love to hear sort of, it doesn't have to be specific, but when you say, I think there's a bit too much, talk about that balance.
I was just about to, before I did that, I was just going to court absolute controversy here, which is if you want to read the accident report about the F-35 that flew into the sea off the front of the carrier a couple of years ago, because, and I might misquote the report here, and I apologise if I do, but the way I read it, the team that was tasked with preparing that aeroplane was a two-person team. They both did half the job at different times, and no one on the deck supervised them. And a contributory factor was it was raining and it was at night. And I would argue that back in the day, on the teams that I worked in, the senior supervisors would have said, because it's raining and because it's night, we need to be on our game here. We need more supervisors on the deck. And there's no way on God's green brackets and blue earth that two folk are going to do half a job each and do it at different times.
So that seems to come back to the, it's not about, in this case, too much process. It's about the right process and about smart people being able to understand what the right process at the right time is.
But I think I can say from the report that the process wouldn't have saved them anyway, because the thing that downed the aeroplane was hidden inside it. It's just an observation on how they went about their business. So, but to answer your direct question, the thing that made me smile, which you might have noticed, was we actually came under some Royal Air Force regulations when I was still in the Royal Navy, and I thought a few of them were a little bit too onerous. There were knee-jerk reactions to previous instances where, instead of being able to cuff someone around the head and go, that was stupid, there was now a regulation to deal with it. And I'll give you a really simple example. All formation changes between aircraft had to be called on the radio. And to me, that was an anathema of professional aviation. If my wingman wasn't clever enough to work out where I wanted him at the right time, well, he was a stupid wingman as far as I was concerned. And the fact that I was now told that I had to tell him that I didn't mind how clever he was, I was going to tell him where to be, I thought that was over-regulation. So that was what I was getting at.
No, it's interesting, but it proves to me that's why I can never have been a Sea Harrier pilot, but perhaps a GR9 pilot. No, that's not true.
You talked earlier about the difference, or you alluded to the difference in culture, and you talked about the different behaviours of the fleet air on guys and girls at the back of the ship dealing with, well, not at the back of the ship, it's an aircraft carrier, so dealing with the airframes and the fact that if you run out of fuel, you're going to sink, and then the rest of the surface fleet, chaps and chapesses, sort of doing what they do, and the difference because of the consequences created different behaviours. My experience of being at sea is, as a Royal Marine team commander, was a third group where you had the fleet air arm, people at the back of the ship dealing with the helicopter, you had the surface fleet managing to fight the warship, and then my team getting ready to go and do what we were doing. And at that time, it was board and search operations in counter-piracy and counter-terrorism operations. And I always found it really interesting that there were three very distinct cultures that behaved in three very different ways. And I found often that my team were perhaps a lot more relaxed, a lot less procedural, but we tended to have either more time to work out the problems, i.e. we're not travelling at 6 miles a minute, and if we run out of fuel, we're not going to crash and burn, or the problems we were solving were so fast that it was muscle memory and individual reactions to what was going on. i.e. you're now in a firefight in a tactical situation. And we did a whole episode on how you get that balance through a combination of rehearsed procedures and drills and allowing mission command judgment. The Navy, fighting the warship, I found were very, very procedural. And that made them very, very good at dealing with known situations, but particularly bad at applying judgment to situations that they perhaps hadn't experienced before. And counter-piracy was one of those things that was probably quite uncomfortable. We were dealing a lot with small arms, a lot with sort of terrorism-type threats, and a lot of situations that I don't think your average warfare officer in the Navy will be thinking about and dealing with on a daily basis. So if you've ever been on a ship and watched them deal with a flood or a fire, even if it's a drill, it's phenomenal. And I was blown away with how professional and capable they were. The moment there was any kind of, I've got a potential pirate who I think has a communicable disease, the whole thing fell apart. I've got a language problem, and I think this guy's trying to tell me something that is going to be useful for the intelligence for the next boarding operations. These kind of things they couldn't cope with. We've talked a lot so far about you flying the aircraft safely and managing the complexity of the machine. We haven't talked about the fact that it's a combat aircraft. and then you're flying it to fight it and be part of a combat environment where the enemy, as the cliche goes, has a vote. There is a changing and dynamic threat situation, and the environment is difficult and can change at any moment. We've talked a lot on this podcast about the ability to be agile and adapt to new environments. How do you do that? How do you get the balance right between being procedural enough that you are safe and also pushing the boundaries enough that you can be agile and adaptive to a new situation?
I think this talks to both the maritime thing and the combat thing, which is you learn and you stick absolutely to the regulations. All the regulations, even the onerous ones, are written in blood one way or another. No one's put them there for fun. And then the answer is you prioritize. And if one of them gets in your way, you make a judgment as to whether or not you could break or bend that in order to carry out what you consider the priority to be.
How do you learn that? So you have many hours of experience, many hours of experience on all of these things, through from flying an aircraft to combat and just experience. How do you take green people and how do you teach them that in a safe way? Because at some point you have to drop them and say, now make the decision where you'll win or lose. How do you get to that point? Because I think people often talk with survivor bias about the people who did it without cause to how they got there, or the people who didn't get there.
Yeah, and we mentioned
that. How do you make that hop across?
When we talked about Paddy Mayne and David Stirling, we talked about the fact that, you know, they're heralded as heroes, but actually at the time they were breaking military law. They were doing things that, and if circumstances had ended up a different way, they would have gone down in history as, you know, reckless distractions during a war that didn't need reckless distractions.
They wouldn't have gone down in history because they'd be just...
it's a great question.
How do you get from the guy who is flying a little grob around or whatever it was back in 96 to a person flying down a canyon making decisions about how to prioritise those rules?
I think the answer is constant training, and the training is not a case of... going to laugh at Gareth here. Now, it's not like people in camouflage doing press ups. Our training is
an important. The look is important as well.
Yeah.
To be fair, from a man who walks around with a sort of bone dome, looking pretty cool in a grow bag, so both of you are just as guilty.
But unable to do press ups. training comes in many forms. It's relentless. Obviously, every single day you are training to do your job. So every day you're making tactical decisions. And you will be led initially. So when you go as a FNG to the front line, you are led, and then you become a pairs leader.
Flying new guy, by the way.
And all the time, you're being imbued with a sense of that decision-making. And all the time, you practice every day, and I'm sure the Royal Marines are the same. I'm sure all walks of the military are the same. This is no duff today. You are defending the ship, and you are to die rather than let someone pass this line. So the notion that this is a high-risk game and you are eventually going to have to prioritise with members of your formation, your aeroplanes and lives, is actually imbued in you right from the start. So you then go on big missions and you get told what the mission risk level is. We are prepared to lose aircrew.
Do they actually articulate?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. We're prepared to lose aircrew today to achieve this. You know, it's a, you know, pick any. WMD is being discovered in Wick. We are prepared to lose 10 aircrew.
Do you know what? We don't have that in the business world. Well, no one has said we are willing to lose people today to make sure the servers carry on.
So, and then you will also, by your, when you are a leader and you'll receive this from leaders, you'll be told, look, we're not going to risk anything today. It's just a transit flight. We're not going to push the weather. And you do end up
in you talk about the risk a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's really interesting. There's another piece of this as well, which I think for me is really interesting, which is how do you know when to say stop to people? So you know, I got as far as Dartmouth just about, and I then got to Yeovilton, and they decided, or Culdrose, and said no, thank you. But there's a point all of a sudden where, you know, you're out of fast jet training, you're now in a Harrier. And even then there's train levels, it must be harder to say, you know what, it's time for you to stop. How do you make those calls as a senior pilot, you must have had times when you went, this is not the right place for this guy.
Yeah, you will, and everyone gets them wrong. And the really important thing about the aviation community is you're allowed to get things wrong, and you're allowed to discuss them, and you're expected to discuss them. The only person who will ever get kicked out of a squadron or a force is someone who lies, not someone who's done wrong and says, look, guys, I'm really sorry. I thought I could get into that particular airfield. I ended up 20 feet below the limits. I shouldn't have done it. Well done. Go and make yourself a coffee. Don't do it again, type thing. The person who says, oh, yeah, I saw the light at 400 feet. You go, no, you didn't. You're a liar. I don't trust you. And you can't have people on your team that you can't trust. You can't have people on your team who lie because you're never going to learn from them. So that really is the case. And what I was going to say about the training is it's all consuming. So training isn't just flying an airplane. Training is doing your reconnaissance training. It's reading the emergency of the day. Every single day you're told before you go flying, what are you going to do if your fuel pumps don't work? And then you have to go through the drill. Every day you read a accident report. Might not be your aircraft, but this is an accident from a Sea King. And for whatever reason, he went back for one last underslung load and ended up crashing in a field. What? Why? And so there is the notion of press-on-itis, as it's called. Your job to be a truly effective naval or any other aviator is to know where that balance is. And there will be times when people come up to you and go, mate, you pushed it too far today, that you were right on the limits for this, or the ship went out of limits and you knew it was going to. Let's wind it back a bit. And on others, you'll say, right, look, you said we weren't going to go because of the weather. I told you it would be fine. Look at the weather reports. We've just made a complete whatever of ourselves in front of in a close air support game. That's probably where it's trickiest, where you're trying to give a service and defend a reputation. Those sorts of ones. That's where it's really easy.
That statement about defending a reputation, I talk a lot about this where I work, which is for some people that might sound odd, defending a reputation, so it doesn't matter. I think what you're talking about is trust as well, that other people trust you, that you have a reputation as well.
100%. So, for example, and this is why you do it, I was in the CAS stack in Afghanistan, and for whatever reason, things were cooking off in a nasty area.
Just for our listeners, CAS is close air support. In the stack, in the sky, waiting to support people.
I'm not going to let's tell the story. We have to have some narrative tension. Let's stop for a second. And actually, joking aside, let's come back. This is, I think, really interesting. And I think this is a great way to talk about that prioritization as well when you talk about it. So let's stop for a quick break, build a bit of narrative tension, and come straight back. Well, welcome back. Thank you for sticking with us for what must have seemed like ages. I know it did for us. Paul, I rudely interrupted you. You were just talking about in a CAS stack above Afghanistan.
And we were talking about the trust that you've engendered with other folk. In this case, the terminal attack controller or the forward air controller on the ground, the person who is actually going to ask you to employ weaponry onto the enemy. And for whatever reason, there were quite a few of us around that day. There was a French formation around, there was an American formation around, and there was another British aircraft. The British aircraft was doing a slightly different mission. There were a lot of folk on the net. And when it became apparent that the ground situation needed weaponry to be dropped, obviously everyone started chipping in with how much weaponry they'd got on board and why theirs was slightly better than everyone else's.
Is it a bit of a negotiation?
It shouldn't be, but there's always an element of gamesmanship. Anyway, clear as a bell, the British JTAC said, right, everyone on the net, shut up. The British Harrier is taking this one. And why did he say that? It wasn't because it was me, a Harrier, or my weaponry. It was because for the last 3 years, when the weather was grotty and these guys were getting cold backsides on hills in Scotland and Spade Adam, you made it your business to get in. And that meant pushing the limits. And it meant the nightmare scenario in your silly little Harrier head is I can't see the ground. I'm going to have to find some sea near Newcastle. Then I'm going to have to wheedle my way through hills, etc. But I'm going to do it because if I don't, there's going to be a tornado crew that does. And I don't care what the tornado crew think, but I care what those boys on the hill think. So tighten the straps, gum shield in, this is going to work. And that then puts you in a position where you're now risking stuff, but you're doing it because of what someone else might think. And the fact that the one, two, three, five, 10 years of Harrier drivers before you did exactly the same thing.
That, I mean, we're touching on tradition mm-hmm. and the importance of the mission. I mean, again, it can almost sound like a cliche, you know, you gum shields in, let's go kind of a thing. But can you talk about that? I mean, particularly when you're in Afghanistan, how important was it to you personally to deliver on that? What did it mean to you and the rest of the pilots that were flying this?
I'd say everything. I can only remember one case, and we were there as a force for over 5 years, where I read a report and I thought, you know what, you could have done better in this situation. And what that was that a crew who had been supporting a long fight, and these fights are never long fights, or they weren't for us anyway, in so much as, and Gareth will have to forgive me because I've never been in a firefight. You might turn up to a task, there will be a firefight, and then you'll be in Overwatch for an hour, and then something will kick off, and then you'll be in Overwatch for an hour. So this pair were doing that and going to the tanker and back. And then they had an argument because it got dark, and one of them was not actually qualified to fight at night. And I can remember reading the report going, oh, guys, we could have just papered over that particular crack and just got on with it. But that was a really, really isolated incident to the point that it was the one. All the rest, I think we were hard up against the right-hand stop because, and you don't want to get too emotive about it, Chris, but you say, look, I've never been in a firefight, but if my boy, girl, nephew, cousin was in a firefight and I heard that the fixed-wing guys had denied them the weaponry they'd wanted, I'd find that person and I'd explain what I thought of their decision.
Yeah.
And it was a case of if the ground commander wants support, he gets support, he or she.
It's fascinating, having been at the other end of that, being on the ground in the firefight and requesting the support. There is, well, firstly, every time I requested support, and I'm not a trained JTAC, so it's very rarely me actually on the radio doing it, but every time we requested fire support, the team, so there's a whole load of people in this system, absolutely worked as hard as they could to deliver it. And that gives you confidence going into the next firefight. And so that trust relationship is really important. But there was always this conversation going on about pilots that wouldn't push on beyond their, you know, 8 hours or whatever it is, because they needed to get their enforced rest because it's the rules and it's the law. And my experience is that actually, like you say, the rules are there. The rules are there to be followed until the situation dictates that they're not. But it did create this tension, and it created this argument of, well, you know, do they not realise that there are lives at stake? And it created a cultural problem until, for me personally, my unit, we were training down in Celebridge in Wales. And we had an air crew come and see what we were doing and actually jump into, you know, our sections and get involved. And they got to experience what being in a firefight is like and how quick the decisions are and how difficult it is to judge distance when there's lots of things going on. And they got to talk to us about what they need in terms of information from us. But they also got to talk to us about why those rules are important, how the situations change such that those rules could be broken. And that broke all that tension down. And I think that's really important. But what I think is interesting is you were talking about needing to get ahead of the tornadoes at Spade Adam. And I absolutely can understand that. And we've been in, you know, very similar situations where, you know, it's, you know, 4-5 commando need to do something before 2 para or, you know, whoever. And absolutely that competition becomes quite an important motivator. There is a separate argument about when it becomes quite a toxic thing. But
all of these things are the balance, though. Everything you've talked about today is not the left or the right.
No,
it's
absolutely
finding where the middle is, and it changes every day and every mission.
What I want to explore is the fact that this was Spade Adam, not Afghanistan. And you've highlighted really well why it was important, because by the time you got to Afghanistan, you'd built that trust. The JTAC called you in because he knew that you were going to get the job done. But you had to make the decision in a non-life-threatening situation, in a simulation, on an exercise, to push boundaries. How do you judge that? Because it's very easy to say, in an exercise where no one's going to die, do you know what, it's not worth the risk. But of course, you need to build that experience of taking risk. And secondly, as a leader, how do you let other people make that decision who are more junior to you and they can break rules, which are hard rules, because they judge it's the right thing to do.
Judge is the correct word, and it's forever a course correction, isn't it, really? It's a funnel, and you're trying to just get into some sort of funnel with someone's thinking. I would contend, though, that when you know you are breaking a rule, that's when you stop. So I would have absolutely no problem with someone who came back to me when I was flight commander or senior pilot and said, look, I thought I could get in under the sea. If you can keep yourself away from terrain, it's easier to get under clouds. So you go out to sea and then try and get back in. I tried it. I was in breach of the minimums for a couple of seconds. I gave up. I came home. But no problem whatsoever. If you find that someone genuinely did break rules getting into Spade Adam, you say, you right, that's not acceptable, and you would probably have to go to, the next time you had a sort of supervisory meeting, you'd say, I had a chat with X, we need to keep an eye on him, his balance isn't quite right.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think as well, which is interesting from a learning point of view, is that in military aviation, you're brought up in a way because, and I don't want this to sound too stupid, being at war doesn't actually make your job all that much more difficult or dangerous.
Yeah.
Because the notion that you are going to strap this thing to your backside and go and fly low level around Scotland, Wales, et cetera, et cetera. Accidents happen. So you're forever making risks.
Well, I was going to say, your training is almost as dangerous, if not broadly equally as dangerous, as much of the combat that you might do.
Yeah.
I think there's exceptions to that, clearly, but...
Well, yes.
Train hard, fight easy kind of a thing.
Yeah, of course, with the obvious caveat, which everyone will be miles ahead and got there already, is that particularly in an environment such as Afghanistan, in training, your life is at risk. In Afghanistan, it's other people's. And that obviously raises the ante quite considerably.
Yeah, there's an interesting aspect to that, where in my experience, we training in the UK, the training rules are very, very tight to prevent accidents. So the use of live ammunition is very controlled, and there are things that are put in place to make sure that you're not firing too close to other people for absolute obvious reasons. The first time I went to Afghanistan, when we went through training in country, in Afghanistan, just before we went forward to the forward operating bases, a lot of those rules were lifted. And now we were training with live ammunition, shooting very closely to each other. And of course, the accident risk is hugely increased, but that's mitigated by the fact that the next time you do this, you're going to be doing it for real, and you need to know that you can trust each other. You need to have trained in a far more close to life environment. The second time I went to Afghanistan, somebody had decided, and I suspect it wasn't a person, I suspect it was over time, the system had decided that why take risk in training? And so we ended up in a situation where it was safety rules, safety rules, safety rules. Now we're operating in combat and there's no rules. And the transition was so much harder. How do you apply the judgment? And I suppose this comes back to, in your world of flying fast jets, how do you learn new tactics? How do you learn new ways of operating where you push the envelope, you push the aircraft, you push the system, the procedures, so that you can have that competitive edge without going too far and taking reckless risks? But if you don't do it, you end up never evolving and never being agile on the battlefield.
I think the simple answer is, in fact, despite my earlier quip about regulation, is that actually you're allowed to do an awful lot in peacetime. And every time you fly the aeroplane, for example, if you were to go and to do a exercise whereby you're doing a 1v1 combat, so practice what would be called colloquially a dogfight, you are fighting at the absolute limit. The engine is at 108%, because that is what the cards say you can get out of it. You are flying it to the aerodynamic limit, so it's got buffet on. You're flying your head to its limit. You're just on the edge of greying out, and the G is within 0.1 of the maximum the aircraft can take. So actually, the learning environment is quite clear. And I think the other one that you didn't mention about being on ops is that then we certainly, and I'm assuming you guys did as well, you have to have, we really picked apart what the commander's intent was, what the rules of engagement were, and what we were actually allowed to do.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say that we were all naturally, I think, poachers rather than gamekeepers. in that you would see a whether it's a limit for an aircraft or a low flying regulation or a rule of engagement in combat and go, I know the absolute limit here.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go right up against it. That's just how we were, I think.
What is it that creates that? Because I think we were very, very similar. And as a what would be referred to as a teeth arms combat unit, you'd probably expect that. But what is it that creates those cultures where everybody wants to push the boundaries rather than a culture of everybody adding a little bit of
I want to connect back to the business world in that the real challenge I've seen is the people who say the rules don't apply to me. People who say, I am so clever, the rules say do X, but I'm really clever and I'm going to do Y, which is a very, very dangerous thing in many cases. Now, I sense that yours is a highly controlled understanding of the rules, why they're there, the mechanics of the rules, and therefore what you can push and how you can push, which is very different from I'm special, you're not special, I'm going to do what I want to go and do kind of a thing.
I think you're right. And so in all aviation debriefs, certainly in my time, you always start with your safety points. As in, is there any reason why any of us didn't almost come home today? And to, you know, the other side of that coin would be maybe there's been an accident, say. And the thing that was always at the back of my mind was, particularly when you're operating with other people, is there were training rules. You know, the old Top Gun things about how there's a hard deck, you don't go below, et cetera, et cetera. And I always made it my business. I say, I know what the limit is and I'll go to it, but I'm never going to break a training rule because I never want to look a turkey in front of 60 coalition aircrew and stand up the front and go, yeah, I broke a training rule. I would much rather come back to the debrief and say, hey, I got shot down today by a simulated surface-to-air missile. The reason I did so was because I couldn't turn this way because of a peacetime bit of airspace, maybe, or, you know, different in wartime, but I'm happy to hold my hand up. So there's that. And I think there's the other spectre that sort of haunts you as a military aircrew is, I died doing something stupid. You know, the accident report you open, you go, sorry, you did what? Sorry, I don't understand. I don't want to be the subject of one of those things.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that there might be a direct analogy between our safety points in the military world and the profit and what your company is actually setting out to do. So, for example, have I ever lost a bit of air combat because I came off the limits and the other guy didn't? Yes, I have. He fought his machine, she fought their machine better than I did. They were right on the limit. They knew their stuff. They kicked me around the sky. Absolutely. Have I ever lost a contract because someone in my team put a bit more risk on our cost? Yes, I have. Exactly the same thing. Everyone knew what the limit was. One team went to the limit, the other team didn't. Does that help you out?
Yeah, I'm wondering, and I might be overly sort of loyal, but I think the risk that the military takes is, it seems easy. It seems like, you know, I'm determined to get you to tell this another dip, but you're going to talk about it in a way that says, I did this, I did this, I did this. And everyone go, well, I probably would have done the same thing. There's something about the civilian world, which I just don't, I think too many people go, well, that's easy, it's X. As opposed to you, there's all this computation behind it.
So I was musing about this and I was thinking, actually, there's a concept, and I'll probably disagree with myself within two sentences, but there's almost a concept of there's no such thing as a hard decision. Because, and I'll give you the example, I think it's the one you're angling for. Whereas in Afghanistan, I knew that coalition troops were genuinely locked in a fight to the death below cloud in highly mountainous terrain. And we have had it beaten into us since day zero as aircrew that you don't fly in cloud below a certain height, because in the cloud is hard stuff called mountains. And so the height that you can descend to in that cloud is obviously separated from the mountains by a certain bit. I also knew, though, that the mountains were high and I had faith in my navigational equipment. And so I did something that all pilots in the world will say, on the face of it, you're stupid for doing. You broke a really simple rule, which was you don't go below safety altitude in cloud. I had to, because in my headset, I could hear people screaming and being shot. And so to my mind, this is where you get to the concept of it's not a hard decision. I said, am I, if I fly into a hill, I'm going to look a berk. Mrs. Tremelling is going to get the classic letter, your son died doing something stupid. And I'll just have to explain to Mum later, when we meet up again, that I was doing the best I could and I had to break that rule because of what I was hearing through my headset. And there was no other way of getting weaponry down onto the enemy, who were below the cloud, and I needed to get, because I was only carrying visually guided weapons at the time. I didn't have anything GPS guided that I could drop through clouds, etc. And I would never have criticized anyone who didn't do that, because they would have been obeying, like I say, the thing that had been beaten into them every day. And I can see why you would not have made that decision. And some people listening might say, well, you're lucky you got away with it. And I go, yeah, I did. But I think
there's something more to it, though, which is that is not blasé, I'm special, I'm a hero, I'm going to do it. I think everything you talked about, without you articulating it, was extraordinarily calculated. I get the rules. Mm. I understand the risk. I understand what the downside will be if I don't do this. I have the important thing was, he said, I trust my navigation. And so it wasn't the I'm a hero, I'm going to take them on. It was a calculated decision by an aviator. And there might have been another decision where you'd have said, actually, my kit's not reliable at the moment. Yeah. I may be less likely to do that.
It kind of gets worse, because I was about to say,
I'm trying to make it clear you're a professional here. Don't bite me on this.
No. In so much as there would always come a point where, and this happened on countless missions, both in peacetime and in wartime, where you go, right, I've had enough. This is no long. I'm not achieving anything here, or it's no longer the risk. I've been below this height. I've been below this fuel state. I've been this far away from base. Where I in my head, I'm now saying it's time to draw stumps. There's a seconds, minutes, call it what you will, on hairs on the back of your neck, going, you're pushing this now, mate. You need to either back off or make something happen. In this case, I got to see, and I was about to say, I broke out of cloud. Obviously, I broke out of cloud into thick dust, which was a different challenge. But I could see enough of the ground to say, right, that challenge is now out the way. Now let's deal with the dust, almost like two separate things. But there would have come a point where I say, right, I've got away with that. It's time to say, sorry, I tried.
Yeah.
So that didn't happen in that case.
There are two important questions. One is, you said I wouldn't have judged anybody else if they decided not to do it. Would you, hand on heart, have accepted the decision that you made if one of your subordinates had made it and you didn't have the visceral experience of hearing those screams on the radio? If somebody had flown back to base and said, this is what happened, would you have accepted that they broke the rules?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of, you don't send people out in Afghanistan as two fighters, you know, tiny little fighters, very big country,
yeah,
notably aggressive inhabitants, if you don't trust them to
that's the euphemism of the day, yeah. Notably aggressive inhabitants.
If you don't make those calls, but there will always come a time when you say, okay then, but what did happen? And if I'm trying to think, luckily I don't think any of the people that I was there with presented me with that challenge. There was always the time where you had to set someone down and go, look, I watched you tank today. That's not good enough. And there were times when I remember watching one weapon delivery where something went wrong with the head-up display. And I said, well, look, I wouldn't have dropped that weapon. Actually, it was right at the point that the weapon was about to come off anyway. So it was a case of HUD's frozen, dunk, weapon comes off. So actually, the weapon went exactly where it was being aimed at. But again, you know, not admonishing it, in any brave sense, just a case of make sure you're on your game type thing. But no one ever presented me with that. So, but hypothetically, you go, well, golly, it's a war.
Yeah.
At some point, and I think there might have been in the establishment at the time a shying away from that. In so much as no, you should have got told off because you did this, that, and the other. And then the fact that there was a war wasn't an excuse. You go, well, in my mind, it was. So,
yeah, I think what I'm driving at is these things are judgments.
Yeah, absolutely.
And judgment is subjective. And so it's as difficult to make the decision whether to do it or not to do it as it is whether to admonish somebody or not afterward to prevent that mission creep, to prevent the... Yeah, I know you break the rules, but you know, you saved lives, brilliant. And then the next person breaks the rules a little bit further, and before you know it, you're talking about how special you all are. it's a really difficult balance. And so the second part of my question is really, I think you started to answer it anyway, was what happened when you got back? How did you learn lessons? Not you personally,
well, but collectively. Well, and I want to pick up on this, because you've said, you've casually talked about some activities and we haven't called them out. And in my world, I don't think we do enough of this. So in my, just to be clear, you're not the only cool person in the room. I do agile software development, so suck on that. But in my world, we have a thing called a retrospective, that after you do a piece of work, you sit down and you all talk about how it went. And it's about how do you continuous improvement. And there's a significant percentage of people who say, oh, I hate the retro. I don't like that. It's no good. And I think that's terrible. This is your chance as a team to talk about what we did. Every single thing we've talked about today, every story, began or end with, we sat down and talked about it and resolved it. So to talk more about that, how do you get to a point? Lots of people are not keen to do that because they think, I'll be told off, I don't want to hear it. Sounds like there is a sense of trust, and not only trust, but necessity to have that conversation. So in this case, when you got back, what did people say? Was it tea and stickies or?
No, so both absolutely correct. If you don't debrief, you will never learn. So in all cases, actually, you would debrief as a formation. You would debrief with the intelligence officer because he had to handle in the mission report. And if anything notable would happen, you'd also talk to the warlord, the person on the desk. And if something really notable had happened, we would certainly discuss it, certainly in the next squadron off day, but probably the next day, just talk me through, et cetera, et cetera. And what actually happened when we got back was, and this is an interesting dynamic, because my best friend was my immediate superior in Kandahar as well. We're both the same rank, but a slightly different. He brought us in and said, what have you been doing? You know, we were hearing the in-flight report that you give. What have you been doing? And he actually came at me quite aggressively. And when I explained to him, I said, Chris, sit yourself down. This is what happened. He was 100% supportive. And what was brilliant, I thought, was that our chain of command, Royal Air Force, two cases, they were only separated by about 10 days. That action that we just talked about, where the one star Royal Air Force guy actually bothered picking up the phone and saying, what you did today was tremendous. Well done. And then 5-10 days later, we actually withheld a couple of weapons for a coalition bunch that just didn't, nothing seemed right. It was almost like they wanted to drop the weapons for fun. There didn't seem to be any threat to life, etc. We withheld weapons, immediately reported that, and got the same phone call from the one star Royal Air Force. What you did today was spot on. Well done. But to answer your question, immediate debrief, and it has to be, I would say, very well led and culturally imbued. And the way we do that in the military world is you start senior person first and say, right, you almost stand up and tell people what you got wrong this week.
Yeah.
And you have a culture of letting people know what went wrong. It sometimes needs to be brought to people's attention that we're actually quite good at our job, and we only ever discuss the what went wrongs. But the ability by example to stand up and tell people what went wrong and what's important to debrief is critical.
I mean, as we go through this, I mean, obviously there's a big amount of loyalty here for me, but I think people should go back and listen to this podcast again, A, because it helps our numbers, but B, there are so many things in there that you've talked about as casual comments that reflect on things we've talked about. So that praise, that one star picking up a phone and saying that was a good job, is unusual, unanticipated, and makes you walk taller and say that confirms what I'm doing. So there's all of these things. I'm not going to let you off, though. So you've had all the really good stories, and we could talk a lot more about this, because there's nothing like, this is what Gareth said, sitting in a bar and moving your hands around. I wouldn't understand any of that, but there you go. But I've got a last semi sort of...
How do you know there's a pilot in the room?
How do you know there's a pilot in the room, Gareth?
He'll tell you.
I'm not allowed to say. Look, there was a look of disdain on Paul's face there, which is why I didn't make that joke.
But we never have to. Someone else always points it out for us.
Oh, see, look at that. That's even worse. But there's a serious question in there. And actually, it's genuinely a serious question, which is, how do you trade off arrogance and confidence. And I want to, before that, everyone thinks that sounds really rude, I want to qualify this, which is, I think as even a baby failed aviator, the whole deal when you start is you have to have the confidence that you can succeed where everyone else will fail. Just the fact that you are strapping that aircraft to yourself, I think there is a degree of confidence, if not arrogance. And, you know, you made the joke. That is one thing about aircrew, whether they're rotary or fast jet, is that real sense of we are great at what we do. And reading your book, there's a fascinating dichotomy of we're great at what we do, but also there's humbleness in there as well. And I think that's really interesting. By the way, I think you have to think you're great at what you do, otherwise you wouldn't do some of the things you do. How do you balance arrogance, confidence, and humility?
I would argue this in a possibly a slightly controversial way. I have met very, very, very few single-digit, one-hand, arrogant pilots. I have met hundreds of confident pilots. And the reason is because, just like any other bit of the military, you're going to go and do something quite high octane. You cannot fail and your life is at stake. If you're not confident, there's no place for you in the room. However, arrogance is, I would argue as well, a perception from the outside as opposed to what's internal. And I think that the vast majority of military aircrew would say, I know how good I am. Why? Because I've sat a darned test every single day of my life and someone has told me. And I know exactly how good I am compared to someone else because we've kicked each other around the skies. So I don't think it's arrogant. You know, if you walked down the road with a big sign saying, I passed the Sea Harrier Operational Conversion Unit, it's just a statement of fact. People would take it as arrogance. In the aircrew world, it's, well, okay, so you did. That guy over there passed the Chinook course. That guy over passed the...
Well, I'd go once if I suspect if you had truly arrogant people, you probably wouldn't want them on the squadron with you, because arrogance implies, true arrogance as opposed to perception, implies I'm special, the rules don't apply to me, I'm somehow better than everyone else and I can do what I want.
And you would fail in flying training because you wouldn't learn. If you don't have the humility to say, I am fallible, I messed up, I need to learn from you, I need to do better tomorrow, you're simply never going to make the grade. Does that answer the question?
No, I think that's...
I think you've answered the question throughout this episode anyway by reinforcing the fact that all of the conversations you have internally between you and the other aircrew, between you and the ground forces that you're supporting, between you and your commander when you get back, it's all been about, why did you do this? What could you have done differently? Don't do that again. Or well done for taking that risk and making that judgment. And it's all been self-critical and analysing of why decisions were made, rather than, you know, everybody getting back, high five, let's go to the bar, aren't we great? And I think if you were genuinely an arrogant culture, which I think you're right, it's a perception thing, it would all be, how good are we? Let's go to the bar. Actually, it's a constant battle of how can we learn more lessons? How can we be better? So although there's an immense sense of confidence that is projected outward, internally as organisations, you're constantly self-critical. And I think that's the difference. And I only learned that having been a Royal Marine watching, you know, aircrew, thinking, they always want to tell you, they're always, you know, and it is cool. And I have to admit, you know, watching aircrew walk out to a fast jet is cool. And there is something inside of me every time that goes, maybe I should have done that instead. But having then had the privilege of working on an air squadron, of worked with aircrew of various different nations, but and watching how hard they work to make sure that the confidence that they project outward is absolutely earned, it's humbling to watch. And I think that's the difference.
Because I think we're getting to time, I'm going to ask Chris a question. So imagine you get your air tasking order 3 hours before takeoff, and you've got an hour and a half of fuel. So it's 3 hours of planning, including getting in, an hour and a half of flying, roughly, 10 minutes of signing the jet back in. How long do you think the debrief takes?
I'm going to hope it's an hour and a half.
Yeah, at times for a complex strike, maybe 3 hours.
And my training tips is because every time we did a flight, admittedly in training, that's exactly what we do. But I think it's good. Look, we're coming to the end. I first of all, I want to say thank you, Paul, for coming, for giving us time. Secondly, I gave you a bit of stick because there are a number of my friends who, if I didn't give you a bit of stick, would have been annoyed. But I do want to say I am very proud of my naval roots and what you and my ex-colleagues have done. And so I want to thank you for coming on, but also, this is going to sound corny, thank you for that service, because it means a lot that that's what, when I joined the Navy, that's what it stood for me, that we'd go do that. Anyway, enough of that potential gushing. What I do want to say to everyone listening is, genuinely, please go and read the book. It is Harrier by Commander Paul Tremelling, How to Be a Fighter Pilot. It is a rip-roaring read. You know, before I bought this, I read all the quotes and it sort of talks about a sense of humour. If you want to understand the ethos of, certainly I could say, the Royal Navy and Royal Navy aviators, I think it captures it brilliantly, from moments of humour, couple of discussions about time in the bar and how much alcohol was taken at the requisite times after the mission, then you definitely, definitely want to go and read this. I can absolutely recommend it.
Brilliant. Yeah, I just want to reiterate Chris's point. Thank you, Paul, for giving up your time. I think this has been another fascinating discussion and it's opened up some new areas
we didn't even talk about air accident investigation. We're gonna have to get it back. The next one, though, we will do in a pub, because we keep talking about doing stuff out
and about. Let's commit to that. Yeah, that's all for now. So thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, if you want to comment on this episode, you can find us on X at Battling with Biz, that's Biz with a Z, or you can email us at battlingwithbusiness@gmail.com.